Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Wednesday, May 11th, 2016. And the question lingers. Senator Sanders, when will you show us your tax returns? Bernie Sanders won a big victory in West Virginia on Tuesday night, defeating Hillary Clinton by a margin of about 13 points. There were a couple of extra local candidates in the race there that split the vote. But Sanders is chugging along. He's held big rallies here in California and also in Oregon last night. He's in Missoula, Montana today, and my friend Nancy Walton is there cheering him on. And his hanging in this race is having an impact, not only as the primaries play out and more voters get to express their preference, but Hillary Clinton has had to respond to this continuing challenge by shifting her position on health care reform. Now, she's not jumping into Medicare for All and single-payer health care, but just this week she started talking about the need for a public option, something that was discussed and discarded by the Obama team during the wrangling over health care reform in 2010 and 2011. And it's very interesting because this has also pressured the Clinton campaign to resume campaign ads on TV. They had said that after the end of April, they're going to conserve money for the general election. They've got it all wrapped up. They don't need to worry about Sanders anymore, and so they're going to conserve their cash. But they've gone back on the air in Kentucky, where the primary is going to be held next Tuesday, and I believe the polling shows Sanders ahead. So this is all very interesting. The West Virginia victory was notched with a margin that is quite a swing, because back in 2008, when Clinton faced Obama in West Virginia, she beat him by 40 points. Now, it's fair to say that that number was augmented by Republicans who crossed over. Their primary had already wrapped up, and so people like Rush Limbaugh were encouraging their fans to change over to the Democratic primary and disrupt the momentum of Barack Obama at that point. So it's not a complete apples-to-apples comparison, but it is interesting. And I give Bernie Sanders credit. Last night, he claimed victory in West Virginia from Salem, Oregon, where he had another huge crowd in an auditorium that had to turn people away because, in some cases, they turn people away or they keep them outside because they can't process them all in through the Secret Service screening. We've learned that from rallies recently in Sacramento. So I give Bernie credit. And also, last night I was looking for coverage, and over at MSDNC, they were running a regular Rachel Maddow show. And so I went to CNN, and they were covering the primary in West Virginia. There was also a Republican primary in Nebraska, and they covered Sanders' speech. They kind of gave him the Trump treatment. They, you know, had coverage of the empty podium waiting for Bernie to arrive, and then he launched into it. And to their credit, CNN let him talk for 22 minutes before they said, oh, we've heard all this before, and let's go back to our talking heads here in the studio. I flipped over at that point and did not see the speech on MSNBC or on Fox, and I don't know if they carried part of it or, you know, even a snippet or two. So it is interesting to see, and California is going to be a real determinant to the Democratic primary this year. We get to vote on June 7th. It is a delegate-rich package that the winner will get the majority of, and it's going to be very interesting to see just how much impact we have. And in a moment, I'll share with you some quotes from an interview that Sanders gave to the San Francisco Chronicle yesterday, where he broke some interesting new ground. A look at the exit polls from West Virginia shows that 44% of people who voted for Bernie Sanders last night said that they would vote for Donald Trump in the presidential election this fall. Only 23% in West Virginia said they would support Hillary Clinton. Now, this shows in a blue-collar, coal-mine state like West Virginia the huge vulnerabilities of Hillary Clinton. And her supporters and her team and the spinmeisters in the media play this down. But the numbers do not lie. And when you put them together with the state-level polls that show Sanders beating Trump by a bigger margin, or in some cases beating Trump where Clinton does not, and those battleground states are Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Florida. But still, with a lot of emotional rather than rational approach, the Clinton team, the Clinton clan, is sticking together. So it's just fascinating to see how this plays out. ABC's exit poll showed that a third of Democratic primary voters would choose Trump in a general election between him and Clinton, and 44% choose Clinton, and 21% would choose neither candidate. So you can see the trend line there. Now to the item that I led with. David K. Johnston is a man I have deep respect for. He's a guy who won a Pulitzer Prize for his economic reporting at the New York Times. And he's been a guest on this program many times. He tends to mask his own political views because he is a journalist who tries to play it down the middle. But David K. Johnston was one of the first to talk about income inequality issues, the huge tax breaks and other benefits that the wealthy and corporate interests get. And so I think it's fair to say, or to infer, that David K. Johnston would like to be wholeheartedly supporting Bernie Sanders. But his journalism gets in the way. And Johnston writes, Jane Sanders, wife of Bernie, backtracked yesterday on promises that both she and the senator made to release the couple's complete tax returns for the years 2006 through 2013, making what Johnston characterizes as a red herring excuse. Jane suggested that the returns will not be released until Hillary Clinton releases the transcripts of her lucrative speeches to Wall Street firms. And I agree with the next statement by David K. Johnston. Two wrongs do not make a right, and being a good guy politician doesn't exempt one from criticism from those who favor many of his policies. So this is an issue that I believe has to be confronted head on. And I think you know that I am supporting Bernie Sanders over the other candidates for president this year, but it doesn't blind me to his failure to follow through on this. And Johnston notes that maybe Jane Sanders is concerned about her role as the president of a small, financially struggling nonprofit college in Vermont, where she reportedly funneled $500,000 to her daughter and may have made false statements on bank loan papers. But even if Sanders' tax returns are clean as a whistle, says Johnston, we should care about these returns. And that the one nearly complete return they have made for 2014 is pretty standard. Well, that doesn't exonerate them from providing the rest of the information. And Johnston notes that there is only one candidate who has released all of his or her tax returns, and her name is Hillary Rodham Clinton. And I've used that information to criticize her. And I give her credit for at least doing that, and Sanders has no excuse. The issue about the Wall Street transcripts, he can continue to pepper her on that, but it's not the same. And the holdout from Sanders gives strength to Donald Trump, who's trying to deflect, demands to see his tax returns, because, of course, he routinely lies about his net worth, and he doesn't want that exposed. There is some more support surfacing for Hillary Clinton in the email scandal, and I think this is kind of an inside job. The New York Times is doing some comparisons about how certain emails get started and then are passed around, and some of them include unclassified information. And they're basically building the case that, gosh, they all do it, Hillary was not that out of line, and we should just ignore all this. And I don't buy that. Now, I do understand the point made by this article, which is that on a routine basis, because of the State Department's ancient information technology system, and they have what are considered high and low security systems that they communicate through, that, you know, there are many emails that are not properly handled. and information that originates classified is not properly marked, and information that gets passed around is also not properly handled. But this does not excuse her intentional blunder, where she set up this private server hoping to evade Freedom of Information Act requests, and now they're busy trying to make it seem like it's all okay. And I don't believe it is. James Comey, the too tall director of the FBI, said today that he won't be rushed into finishing his agency's investigation of Clinton's emails, and he wouldn't say whether he'll wrap it up even by the November presidential election. "I don't tether to any particular external deadline," he said, "so I do feel the pressure to do it well and promptly. But as between the two, I always choose well." Well, I am not optimistic that the FBI is going to come to any conclusion before the election. And this is really dangerous, because if, in fact, she is liable for any criminal or other charges, wouldn't it be better to know it now than to have it come out in the middle of the campaign? Trump has been able to put off his Trump University lawsuit until after the election. And so Clinton could be deeply wounded as the nominee in October or even the first few days of November if that's when the FBI drops its findings. I mentioned that Sanders came through San Francisco yesterday. He made a visit to the San Francisco Chronicle editorial board, and he broke some new ground. He said that if he's elected, he has learned a lesson from President Obama's failure. Obama tried so hard in his early years to get bipartisan buy-in on health care reform, on other issues, and Bernie says that was a mistake. "I think a keen mistake," quote, "that the president made is that he refused to recognize the reality that these guys, Republicans, were never serious about compromise. He kept extending an olive branch. He kept getting his hand slapped. I do not believe that right-wing Republicans are prepared to work with a progressive president." Nonetheless, he said he will not tack to the center if he becomes the nominee. He said he's going to run on his issues and his posture in the fall if he is the nominee. He dismissed as distorted an analysis by the Tax Policy Center that said his plan to offer tuition-free public college and other programs like single-payer health would add $19 trillion to the national debt, and he is correct in saying that those are distortions. He also, let's see what else he talked about, the delegate lead, which Clinton currently has a 287 pledged delegate margin over Sanders. He says he's going to keep pressing the superdelegates to flip, and some of them are flipping, but not in the numbers that I believe he needs. So he also challenged Hillary Clinton to follow through on a commitment she made back in March to debate him here in California. And I would love to see that. He also responded to this meme that Clinton supporters push on the internet that he hasn't been subjected to real scrutiny, and when Trump lowers the boom on his communist ties and his visit to the Soviet Union, that it's all going to, just destroy him. And he turned to his wife, Jane, and said, "They can demagogue my honeymoon in the Soviet Union. Do you remember that, Jane? We went with 10 other people. That was our romantic honeymoon, to establish a sister city to calm down the tensions and create a more peaceful relationship with the United States. Yeah, I plead guilty to doing that." Just moments before I started talking into this microphone, I got word that the Supreme Court in Brazil has rejected a final appeal from President Dilma Rousseff, as the Senate in Brazil is, at this hour, moving to impeach her. And the process requires a vote of the Senate. She would be notified if the measure passes today, and tomorrow she would be booted for 6 months from office while the impeachment proceedings and trial go forward, and she will be temporarily replaced by the Vice President, Michelle Temer. And this is all happening very fast. It's quite dizzying the way these things are occurring. And I want to recommend, I'm linking to Glenn Greenwald's latest discussion about the crisis in Brazil. He does a great job of putting into context the history and also the connections of Michel Temer and his political party to Goldman Sachs and the very wealthy interests in Brazil. And basically, they have decided that democracy that put the Workers' Party in power for 12-plus years is just too messy, and they've got to stop it. And so they are using this pretext of a corruption scandal to install, at least temporarily, their guy, who will most likely move quickly to impose austerity programs in the nation of Brazil. This week we've been discussing what started Monday as a criticism from conservatives that Facebook is biased against them. And they trotted out the confession of a former Facebook editor who told stories about how that happened on his watch. And I have offered that while I can't prove that that's true or not, that I do think that Facebook is not transparent and that it could very easily manipulate public opinions and our perceptions of what is popular and what is going on in ways that we will never know about. And so in the New York Times today, Farhad Manju, who is their tech writer, does a very good job of unpacking these issues. And I'm linking to it, recommend that you read it. A couple of quotes. Facebook operates under a veneer of empiricism. Many people believe that what you see on Facebook represents some kind of data-mined, objective truth unmolested by the subjective attitudes of fair and balanced human beings. None of that is true, he says. This week, Facebook rushed to deny that report in Gizmodo that said the team in charge of its trending news list routinely suppressed conservative points of view. And Gizmodo reported a month ago that Mark Zuckerberg employees asked Zuckerberg if the company had a responsibility to help prevent President Trump. We don't know how he answered that question. So Manju says the question isn't whether Facebook has outsized power to shape the world. Of course it does, and we should worry about that. He says if you wanted to, Facebook could try to sway elections, favor certain policies, or just make you feel a certain way about the world. He says there's no evidence that Facebook is doing that, but we really don't know. And I think he raises a lot of important issues. Every day I like to pause for a second and thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins podcast. And Paul L. Sesser, who is the longest-term, most generous contributor to the Peter B. Collins podcast, sent me an email the other day. He had listened to our April 26 News and Comment podcast, and he wanted to add to a comment I made about union members voting for Republicans. And he's been a union activist, working as a shop steward, negotiating committee member, executive board, and he just retired from a six-year stint as a business agent with the Teamsters in California. And he says, I'm sorry to report that union members have been voting for Republicans for years now. Most that do are ignorant of union history and legislation like Taft-Hartley that was sponsored by Republicans and gutted union power. Or they're making so much money that they buy into the local, into the low-tax myths of the right. And the unions can't deliver the vote anymore with fewer members, so we continue to get the short end of the deal. Thank you, Paul. You make some very good points there. And I also want to recognize a couple of other people today. Pauline Nixon kicks in $10 a month. Multitask Man has been a longtime subscriber. And Carl Hesterberg is a generous supporter as well. I want you to join their ranks. I need more people to subscribe here to keep it all going. As I've mentioned, we've had some defections from people who don't like my point of view on the American political presidential race this year. And that comes with the territory. But if you do like what you hear and you appreciate, for example, that I don't hide bad news about Bernie Sanders like his tax returns, I hope you'll support me. So step on up at peterbcollins.com, click on the menu button, and then become a subscriber. On the subscriber page, you can choose your bonus book if you choose to take out the $50 annual subscription and give me an email address in the continental U.S. And over at NewsBud, at the Kickstarter page, we now have pledges of $54,000, well over a third of the way to our goal of $150,000. 364 people have already pledged, and I invite you to do so. Just go to NewsBud.com, watch the video, look at the business plan, and then you can click on over to Kickstarter to make your pledge. Well, the Republican-controlled Do-Nothing Congress is taking some action. Today, the House of Representatives is scheduled to vote on 18 different bills related to opioid addiction. And I don't have the details on any of these bills, so I'm a little nervous about what actually is included in them. I'm told that some of them are intended to make it easier for doctors to treat patients addicted to opioids, give law enforcement officers greater authority to interdict drug trafficking. Let's see how that works. There are measures that would offer greater protections for veterans and for children affected by the opioid epidemic, and that would require the federal government to conduct studies evaluating the nation's capacity for treating opioid addiction. I don't hear anything about limiting the marketing of the drug companies or holding them responsible for perhaps not sharing the actual addictive nature of these powerful drugs. I'd like to see a little more of that. Cliven Bundy, of course, is the Nevada rancher who is currently in jail in Portland, Oregon, following the Oregon standoff this past winter. And he apparently is being held in solitary confinement, and I can't see any reason for that. He has filed a lawsuit against President Obama, challenging his placement in solitary and also seeking to dismiss the federal government's felony charges that could keep him in prison for a while. The complaint also criticizes the president for his despicable, disrespectful mocking of Bundy at the 2014 White House Correspondents' Dinner. I guess Cliven can't take a joke. I do not joke about solitary confinement, though. I don't support Cliven Bundy and his intentions. But he is entitled to fair treatment in prison like any other American. Over at Shadowproof, Brian Sonnenstein, who covers a lot of important issues relative to prisons, has gotten a hold of documents that raise a number of serious issues about the imposition of the death penalty here in California. Now, currently it's been suspended for a number of years because of federal court injunctions, but the state has been under a court order to provide a new regime for how they will snuff out prisoners who are approved for execution. And in this article, we learn that emails that have been released, about 12,000 pages worth, show a real cynical view by the insiders at the Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. They sharply underestimate the cost of acquiring the lethal drugs, and they rail against people like me who oppose the death penalty for making it harder for them to get deadly drugs from pharmaceutical companies that don't want to be caught selling them. They're willing to sell them secretly, but they don't want the public to know. So, for example, one email shows that a pharmacy was offering to provide the state with the execution drug pentobarbital from a manufacturer. However, the manufacturer wanted the pharmacy to sign an agreement stating that the phenobarbital would not be resold to any penal system that had the death penalty. And reporter Sonnenstein also exposes that they don't know how to estimate the true cost of obtaining drugs for executions. And in one case, they suggested nearly $500,000 would be required to buy a batch. And what I'm wondering is if somewhere in those emails they suggested that they grab that money from assets that have been seized from drug dealers or their lawyers. It's a seamy, seamy world that we live in. Some great reporting from whowhatwhy.com. Russ Baker is the editor there, and James Henry, one of his intrepid reporters, has dug into information recently released by the FBI. And it shows that the FBI lied about the history of its contact with Tamerlan Tsarnaev, the older brother of the accused duo in the Boston Marathon bombing. And the FBI had steadfastly maintained that it determined that Tamerlan was not any kind of a national security threat, and it denies ever asking him to be an informant. Now, that last claim is really significant because the FBI rarely comments on those issues, but in this case, they appear to be so embarrassed that they're violating their own protocols to say, oh, no, no, we didn't try to flip him to become an informant. But what the article shows is that what is called CARP, with two R's, the Controlled Application Review and Resolution Program, was used to possibly manipulate this foreign national, Tamerlan Tsarnaev, into becoming an FBI informant. And the article details the history of the FBI's contact with him. They were in touch with him at least 2 years before the events in Boston. And a former FBI retired special agent told Who What Why that this CARP system and the references in Tsarnaev's file are pretty good evidence that CARP played a role in delaying action on his citizenship. And the reason is that there were apparently mentions in his file that he was on a terrorist watch list. So all of this is important because the corporate media showed no interest in exposing the true nature of the Tsarnaev brothers' contact with the government before the Boston Marathon bombing. And it raises a whole stack of questions that are explored in this article, and I've linked to it in the show file in the podcast at peterbcollins.com. A former NSA official who's been a guest on this program, whistleblower Bill Binney, has repeated a claim that he told me a couple of years ago, and that is that the NSA is drowning in the data it collects. It has so much information from our phone records, from all the surveillance tools, from the signals intelligence and human intelligence, that they can't really get through it all. And he blames this glut of info that they've collected. He says that's why they couldn't stop the Boston bombing or the Paris shootings, because the data was all there. It was all there. The NSA is great at going back over it forensically for years to see what they were doing before that, but that doesn't stop it. He called this a bulk data failure. He said the problem runs deeper across law enforcement and other federal agencies, which all have access to NSA intelligence. And so this is a very important issue where the government keeps, you know, rejecting efforts to reform the invasive and massive surveillance of Americans in the United States, and they're collecting so much of this shit that they can't sort through it to find the actionable intelligence that they need. Another NSA employee has once again gone public. His name is Eric Fair. He worked for the NSA, and then he jumped over to a private contractor and went to Iraq, where he was assigned to the Abu Ghraib prison as an interrogator and a torturer. And he seems to have some deep regret about this. He's got a book that is soon to be published, and we expect it to explore. The book is called Consequence, by the way. In it, he recounts the daily work of manipulating and mistreating prisoners, even as he became disillusioned with the idea that such interrogations produced any intelligence value. And at one point, he sent a warning flare up the chain of command saying, hey, we're torturing people here, and I'm not very comfortable with it. And he was told to sit down and shut up. And so I think it's a pretty interesting piece. I credit The Intercept for bringing that story forward. And relatedly, at The Guardian today, there's a powerful op-ed, a blistering op-ed from Alberto Mora. And he was general counsel of the U.S. Navy back at the time that Abu Ghraib was exposed. And in this very strong op-ed, he demands that the courts stop rejecting cases of tortured victims. And he says that many of them have been rejected on false claims that there isn't enough evidence, or that the courts would be interfering in military decisions, or that, state secrets are involved. He refers to the various legal maneuvers as contortions, willful blindness. He also says flatly that the Geneva Conventions have always applied at Abu Ghraib, even if you can say that maybe they didn't at Guantanamo. And so this is a guy to be reckoned with. I'm going to see if I can track him down for an in-depth interview. And he closes his piece by saying the Abu Ghraib guards and contractors may have smirked at the laws on torture. Our courts must not. And I've also been pursuing comment from the lawyers involved in the case in Spokane, Washington, that is moving forward a suit against the CIA contractors who designed the torture program, Mitchell and Jessen. And I haven't been able to secure comment from people involved in that case. And I just want to mention in general to my loyal listeners and subscribers, I recognize I'm a little behind on my commitment to bring you two in-depth interviews a week. I have one scheduled to record this afternoon that we'll bring you tomorrow, but I've just had problems getting people to respond and set up times, and I have numerous invitations out. Sometimes they all respond at the same time. I'm working on it. Things are coming. And two final notes from the wars that never end. The New York Times today does a forensic analysis of the events of last October in Kunduz, a province in Afghanistan. And we know that there's been a deep investigation and slaps on the wrist to those involved in the errant bombing of the Doctors Without Borders hospital in Kunduz. But even before that, the U.S. had to violate its own rules of engagement and send Army Green Berets to fight on the front lines of this combat against the Taliban in Kunduz. And this has not been reported before, and I think it's a very important finding. It says that despite the White House and Pentagon officials have repeatedly insisted that American troops no longer play that role, well, our soldiers were on the front lines in Kunduz, and we shouldn't pretend otherwise. And finally, today was a brutal, bloody, awful day in Baghdad. At least 80 people were killed in three different suicide bombings, one near Sadr City, two more blasts in the Qadamiya northwestern area of Baghdad, and then another bomb went off at a checkpoint on a commercial thoroughfare in the Sunni district of western Baghdad. So it's been an awful day there. And our policies continue. We pretend that these wars are going to go away and that American policy didn't cause them. I mean, the whole thing is just so frustrating because Barack Obama skates with no accountability, no demands that he explain his policies, and the Congress, which refuses to exercise its duties to either authorize or narrow the limits of the president's war powers, refuses to do its duty, and so we just muddle on. And while currently not a lot of Americans are being killed, well, we are deeply exposed, and these wars appear to be perpetual in nature. Thanks for joining me today for News and Comment. Feel free to share this podcast with absolutely everyone. I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you.